Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite tea-bagging redneck, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar. We are welcoming back to the show today Dr. Jerome Corsi. He is the author of six, count them, six New York Times bestsellers, including three number one bestsellers. He's here today to talk to us again about his book, Where's the Birth Certificate? The Case That Barack Obama Is Not Eligible to Be President. Dr. Corsi, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back with you, Mark. Thank you.
Well, I have to tell you, it seems like since Obama released whatever that electronic document was, you almost have enough material to write a second book. Am I overstating it?
No, I told Joseph Farah that we've got enough here, we could do another book easily. It's clearly the case. This just keeps developing. And I think now the evidence is going to be almost overwhelming that the document released by the White House on April 27th is a fraud. I've got new experts coming forward with new testimony starting next week.
Now, one of the things that we saw, and I think this might have been the first crack in that glass ceiling, is that Major General Vallely came forward and said, and this was posted on your website, WorldNet Daily, that three former CIA agents have looked at the document and had some of their expert associates look at the document, and the conclusion was unanimously that it was a fraud.
Well, I think General Vallely's statement could not have been more important. And he came out in favor, in support, really, of Lieutenant Colonel Lakin, and also saying that he felt that the court-martial of Lakin was a put-up job and completely, a prosecution that should never have happened, and the birth certificate's a fraud. Now, that's a major development, because someone of Vallely's credentials and credibility, you know, having been a Fox News contributor, a major general himself, retired, strong CIA connections, coming forward with experts behind him from the CIA, having looked at the document. This, I think, is a huge crack in the ceiling, as you're putting it. And there's more to come next week. I also think the stories I've been writing, this recent series of stories have made a major impact as well. Not just stories, Doug Voigt filing a 22-page criminal complaint with the FBI on the forensic evidence. I think that was a huge story, showing that Doug Voigt owns a scanner company that he's owned since 1993 in Bellevue, Washington. He's been selling scanners worldwide. And before that, he was a topographer, and he came out with the forensic analysis that the Obama birth certificate was a fraud. Just from analyzing how the document looked in terms of its Adobe characteristics from being created with Adobe software. And then we had that with Paul Ire, who was another, I think, very important. Paul has had a company for decades in New York that did typesetting, and then moved into computer typesetting. And Ira's analysis was that looking at the letters in the Obama birth certificate released on April 27th, different typewriters were used, so obviously it's a composite job, piecing together different pieces and putting them into a final format. I mean, these are the kinds of things, when you get this kind of testimony from experts, I say more expert testimony is coming, starting next week, that the Obama posted document is a fraudulent document. That's, I think, critical. That is really the kind of moving forward that it's going to take to convince the American public that what we've been shown is another lie by the Obama administration.
Well, this isn't just another lie. If this turns out to be the case, this is bigger than Watergate, bigger than the Lewinsky scandal. This will, in fact, be the biggest presidential scandal of all time, will it not?
I think so. I mean, it's like, I don't want to brag on the importance of it. It's not my style, but clearly here you've got a, what I wrote in Where's the Birth Certificate is you've got a fundamental identity theft, as it were, case here that, you know, or put it in simpler terms, the emperor has no clothes. Obama's not who he says he is. And he's done everything he can to keep his identity, to hide records, to stay away from the American public, to lie, to write a misinformation book, Dreams for My Father, is his autobiography, probably authored by Bill Ayers. I think Jack Cashel's right. And this is a fundamental, I mean, and now, you know, now it's a crime. This was part of what we, Joseph Farah and I, strategized when we decided to keep the book Where's the Birth Certificate in the title. I mean, in February, before February 24th, I was tipped off by my informants in out in Hawaii that the forged birth certificate had been created and put into the logbook in Hawaii. We have a mole within the Hawaii Department of Health. And we decided to keep the book before it was published, didn't change the title of the book. We could have. We decided to keep it Where's the Birth Certificate, knowing that Obama might just release the birth certificate, then they'd win a temporary public relations advantage. The Obama administration could say, where's the birth certificate? It's on our website. But what changed and what's different now and why we kept it that way, the strategy was, I wanted to see if we could sufficiently cause Obama to feel fear to want to block the publication of this book. Anybody who's read this book, the Obama administration will not survive the challenges in this book. It's too patently obvious that he's not eligible to be president, even if he was born in Hawaii. But we can get into that. The issue is that now Obama did flinch. He did release the birth certificate. He blinked. And there's a couple things different. One, Obama's in the chain of evidence. He came down to the White House press room and he said, this is my birth certificate. So he can't say, my people released this. I didn't know about it. I didn't authorize it. He owns the document, Obama. And secondly, now the Obama administration rises or falls on the authenticity of that document. If it's shown to be a fake document, the Obama administration, it's hard to imagine how they stay in office.
One of the questions I have for you, and I've gotten this emailed to me by liberals who support Obama, is that whenever we talk about the enormous amount of money that Barack Obama has spent to keep his life a secret. We estimate the amount, I guess, by now it being over $2 million. And when we point out the invoices from Obama, Organizing for America, or I guess then it was Obama for America, people say, well, maybe he hired Perkins Coal to do some other legal work for him. How do we know that all this money was spent protecting the birth certificate, protecting the Social Security card? How do we know that, Dr. Corsi?
Well, we'd have to be able to see the billing hours. I'd be happy to take a look at them. But, of course, that's another secret document Obama won't allow to be looked at. So, you know, the liberals are asking a question. They know that we can't get the data to respond to them.
How many lawsuits have there been seeking the birth certificate?
20, more than 20.
Yeah, I see that racking up $2 million in legal fees.
And also, remember, Robert Bauer got moved inside the White House and made White House counsel. And then with a presidential order, Obama allowed him to continue working on eligibility cases. So a good deal of this money is buried inside the White House budget. How much did Robert Bauer get paid? How much of his time was working on the eligibility cases? How much staff time was applied to eligibility cases? What were his expenses? I mean, again, we won't get the records.
So the American
$2 million is a more than reasonable estimate.
So we now have the American taxpayers footing the bill
for
some of Obama's legal protection money?
Correct. In fact, Robert Bauer just resigned from the White House after the birth certificate was released, and I've maintained, my sources tell me, that was his John Dean moment. In other words, the birth certificate was released from the White House. It had been forged, I'm convinced. Between the time when Governor Abercrombie, came into office in January, stated he was going to look for the birth certificate, couldn't find it. By February, March, that was apparent. Well, I was told in February that the birth certificate had been forged, and it was down the logbook. So the decision was made, I believe. I don't think, you know, Obama told anybody it was forged. Maybe Valerie Jarrett knew. I'm sure people like Rahm Emanuel or David Axelrod would have known or could have guessed. But probably Bauer, the attorney in the White House, the White House counsel, and Daley, chief of staff, didn't know it was forged. I'm told that Daley made the decision. He said, you've got to show that birth certificate now. They were going to hold it, I'm told, to be an October surprise. You know, release the birth certificate just before the November 2012 election, when we only had 20 minutes to look at it and authenticate it. But by getting them to release it now, many things happen. If it's a forged document, then a felony has been created. So now we have high crime and misdemeanors. Before, it would have just been lying or not eligible. Now you can add to the list high crime and misdemeanor. That's impeachable.
Absolutely. And one of the things I'd like to talk to you about on the birth certificate, though, is let's get this out of the way. There are so many people who at first said the short form is the only birth certificate that the state of Hawaii issues.
Right.
I think someone told me Rachel Maddow is on record as saying there's no such thing as a long form birth certificate.
Right.
Hawaii doesn't provide that anymore. Talk to us about when Hawaii stopped releasing or said they stopped releasing long form birth certificates.
See, that was all a lie. What was happening, I have long-form birth certificates issued by the Hawaii Department of Health in March 2011, this year. So they were still doing it, and my guess is that they still are. You may have to fight to get one, but the law in Hawaii has not been changed, and the law provides that you can get your full birth records if you want them.
And you have one woman who actually got one, and she's got the $10 receipt to prove it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I've shown this in the WorldNet Daily, and I've published it, and it was issued in March 2011.
Wow.
Now, what happened was that the department, when they were not going to release the birth certificate, they started moving toward this cover story, saying they weren't going to do that anymore. Those were done. Everybody had to get electronic. But it wasn't true. The law was not changed. The Hawaii Department of Health, in collusion with Obama, just decided that was going to be their new cover story. Okay, now, Obama, I maintain, had no intention of releasing the long-form birth certificate right now. He was going to hold on to it. But when Daley saw, you know, his combination, I think my book coming out and the fact that they knew they couldn't survive the book, the challenges from the book, once people got a chance to read where's the birth certificate, it was going to be obvious that Obama was not eligible to be president and he'd been hiding who he really is. They released the long form, and it's a fraudulent document. I think what happened is that Bauer and Daley had, you know, a moment of truth occur to them, like a John Dean moment, where they realized that they'd been being lied to.
When you look at this document, it's not just forged, but it's poorly forged.
Yes,
because within 24 hours, YouTube videos began surfacing, exposing some of these things. In fact, I've got Carl Denninger coming on the second half of the show today, and he was the first one to expose the issue that the document has kerning in it.
Precisely.
Meaning that and for those of you who don't know what that means, that essentially means that the letters are pushed either closer or farther apart in order to make it look more aesthetically pleasing. Now, another interesting thing that's happened is that people are pointing out that one particular type of typewriter did come into existence a year before Barack Obama was born, and that particular type of typewriter could have done the kerning. But my understanding is that would have to be manual kerning, and why would a Hawaiian official who's basically a minimum wage hourly person take the time to manually kern some words on a birth certificate? I mean, none of that makes any sense.
It's ridiculous. It's patently absurd. And also the Hawaii Department, the Hawaii hospitals weren't buying the most modern typewriter equipment for the clerks and nurses. There's no reason that they go out and buy fancy typewriters in 1961. Paul Irie's evidence, which also shows there's multiple typefaces in this document, I think, again, rules out that they were using a fancy typewriter that was capable of kerning. I mean, the left doesn't care. The left just wants to give an answer. They don't care if the answer makes sense or if it has, even if they've got an authority saying the answer. They just want to check off your box so they can say, we answered that. Non-responsive answer is okay for the left.
Well, there were so many liberals willing to check that box when he released the short form. But when Obama did actually release the long form, Dr. Corsi, he said, now I know, for some people, there will never be enough.
Right.
They will always quit. Now, was that him realizing that this was a poorly forged document and he was trying to head that off?
Well, I think Obama's been trying to ridicule this issue from the beginning. And if you remember, even Robert Gibbs one day said that even it would ultimately take DNA testing to know who Obama really was. And I thought Gibbs meant that in a way that was dismissive and attempting to be ridiculing, I thought Gibbs is right. It would take DNA testing to know who this guy really is.
I would love to get DNA samples from some of Frank Marshall Davis's descendants and compare that to Barack Obama.
From the father, I mean, Barack Obama Sr., now that we've got the immigration papers from Barack Obama Sr., it's clear in those immigration papers that when I wrote in Where's the Birth Certificate, it's true. You know, there never was a marriage certificate between Barack Obama Sr. and Ann Dunham, the mother and father. They never lived together as man and wife. Barack Obama Sr. always had his own addresses. The immigration file says he always had a bunch of girlfriends. And Ann Dunham, 3 weeks after the baby's born, takes off and leaves Hawaii and goes to Seattle, where she enrolls at the University of Washington in night extension classes and doesn't come home again until after Barack Obama Sr. is gone.
Yet Barack Obama says that his father left home when he was two. I mean,
right.
That doesn't even come close to fitting the narrative.
Another lie. And again, I think the address in the birth announcements was the grandparents' announcements. The mother and father never lived at that address. And so I think, it's a reasonable question. The INS believed, the Immigration Naturalization Service, believed that Barack Obama Sr. had a marriage that was completely a sham. Like many foreigners do, they want to come and marry a U.S. citizen and say they have a U.S. baby as their child, thinking it will provide a reason to extend their waiver to be in the country, their visa to be in the country. And the Immigration Naturalization Service in Barack Obama Sr.'s file say that if he makes that argument, we will contest the marriage. Now, that's really clear. So, but the point is, it's one of the reasons I think the evidence is increasingly conclusive that Obama was born in Kenya, especially after I've released these documents where the Kenyan government searched for Obama's birth certificates and have concluded that, after 2006, the birth certificates in Hawaii were tampered with criminally. So some 40 birth certificates altered in a pattern that they believe was done to destroy Obama's birth certificate. And the Kenyan government told that to Ambassador Ranenberger, the U.S. ambassador in Nairobi, during the George W. Bush administration. George W. Bush was looking for Barack Obama's birth certificate, too.
Let me give you an opportunity to shoot down a couple of liberal myths that are being used to defend this particular birth certificate as being legitimate and to defend Barack Obama as being a U.S.-born citizen. One of the things we hear a lot about, and I know you covered this in the book, but a lot of people listening may not have read it yet, is this issue of, well, there were two announcements in Hawaiian newspapers saying Barack Obama was born. I mean, do you think two newspapers faked it? Do you think they knew back in 61 he was going to be president, so they faked it? Address why or how those announcements get placed in the paper and whether or not there's any credibility or investigation into them before they're put out there.
Well, the birth announcements are triggered by of the recording of the birth in the Hawaii Department of Health. And the grandparents could have come in without the baby, even if the baby was born in Kenya, and say, we want to register this baby as an Hawaiian-born baby. Hawaiian law permitted families to do that. And, in fact, I've even got in the book Sun Yat-sen, the Chinese nationalist leader, has a Hawaiian birth certificate. because a group of people came in and said, we were there when he was born in Hawaii, and Hawaii said, good enough for us. They gave him a birth certificate.
So getting a birth certificate in Hawaii is about as easy as getting a prescription for medical marijuana in California?
About the same kind of process. Okay. Wow. And then both newspapers published the birth announcements in exactly the same order with exactly the same wording. They didn't always do it on the same day. But they just took what was given to them by the Hawaii Department of Health and printed it. Now, the family, let's say the baby's born in Kenya. Mommy goes over there, and I think Ann Dunham went over by herself with her own money to Kenya to get this baby born. I think she wanted to be the Eva Peron of Kenya, come back with Barack after he had his wonderful education. They were going to save the country together. Barack Obama really wasn't interested. He was studying. He didn't have very much money, and he had a lot of girlfriends. He didn't need this particular crazy white woman. I think that's how Barack Obama looked at it and the family in Kenya. That's why I think when she came back, she left 3 weeks after the baby was supposedly born, because Ann Dunham was embarrassed that Barack Obama Sr. was not going to live with her, wasn't going to be the husband, even though they'd all registered him as the husband. Now, in Hawaii, you would say, let's say the baby's born in Kenya, and the grandparents say, Ann Dunham's coming home with the baby. We better go register this baby as an Hawaiian citizen, not because he's going to be president, but because if we don't register the baby as an Hawaiian citizen, the INS is going to be coming around saying, who's this baby? Is this baby a foreign national that we need to have in the Immigration Naturalization Service? I mean, clearly, if the baby could be registered as a Hawaiian resident and a U.S. citizen from birth, it makes it a lot easier. The baby gets to go to school. When it grows up, gets a driver's license, gets a Social Security number, gets a passport, gets to travel freely in the United States. Everybody wants their kid to be a U.S. citizen in Hawaii at this time and everywhere else in this time. So the grandparents go in and they register the baby. Now, it's not even clear that August 4th is the birth date. That may be the day Ann Dunham was coming back. I mean, it's very hard to imagine. We got the documentary evidence. We know Ann Dunham was in school in September 1961 with the baby born in August 1961. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say the baby was 2 months old. You got an 18-year-old girl traveling from Honolulu to Seattle with an infant baby, establishing an apartment, getting a babysitter, and going to night classes all without her mother in 1961. It's hard to believe. Now, if the baby was maybe 4 months old or 5 months old, anybody who's had a baby understands what I'm talking about, a two-month-old is a lot more trouble to deal with than a five-month-old. And so, you know, this is the kind of issue. It doesn't make any sense that Ann Dunham picked up and left. That was a key finding in where's the birth certificate. And I think it helps put into place all this life history that the left lies about. These birth certificate announcements in the newspaper don't prove anything, except that the baby was registered in Hawaii at some point.
Now, you've pointed out that there's no evidence that the two were ever married, but liberals like to point out that there is evidence of a divorce, and why would you have evidence of a divorce if they were never married?
Another one of those non-responsive liberal answers just to check off the boxes and try to make you look stupid in the process. A lot of people end up divorcing each other who never had a formal marriage. The probably most common example of that is what they're considered common law marriages, where people just end up living together for a long time. And then when they decide they're not going to live together anymore, they actually do get divorced, even though there was never a formal marriage. Because by this point, they've got all the property tied together, they've got kids, they've got issues, and the only way to solve those issues really is to go get a divorce. So the courts don't demand that you have a marriage certificate in order to file a divorce. The courts just want to know, you know, that this couple's been living together, there's a cause of action, and, you know, the only legal reason we've really insist upon divorces is because of all the property and children issues that have to be settled when people split up. So divorces can occur without a marriage ever having occurred.
Very interesting explanation. I would like to ask you, where you think this is going. I know you're going to release some more experts next week. Do you think we're closing in on who the forger might be? Because it's obviously someone very, very close to Barack Obama that had to be trusted. The reason the document is so poorly forged is because you can't exactly, you know, send down to the White House printing office or printing room and say, whip me up a fake birth certificate. This had to be somebody.
It's been a request for proposal, you know. Best forger apply here. Prison record, no disqualification. Send me your credentials, your references, your costs, and your hours.
Right.
You know, you can't do that to forge a document. So you got to rely on the people close to you. This series of articles I've been writing about the Obama operatives is very important. You know, I exposed this P.J. Foggy and this guy Riker, who posts on very vehement pro-Obama blogs using foul language like PolitiJab and Fogbo. These guys are like Donald Segretti. They engage in dirty tricks. They've harassed Orly Tate's. They've filed motions in Orly Tate's cases. Even though they're not lawyers at the bar, they've forged birth certificates. They've forged other documents and put them into play. Constantly generate misinformation. What's important, I think people realize that there's a group of operatives out there like this, and Obama's allowed them to support them, if not encourage them. I'm going to write a few more articles. They also include some lawyers with connections, high connections back into D.C. I think we can demonstrate this group of what I'm calling OBOTs, like, you know, Obama robots, OBOTs, have interfered in Lieutenant Colonel Lakin's case. They closed down Greta Wire, Greta Van Susteren's blog. They just posted so much trash on it that Fox News decided to pull the entire blog. And there's characteristics in the birth certificate which are characteristics in a well-known artist in Washington. And, you know, maybe I can't name exactly and say this is the person who for sure did it, but I'm sure by next week, I think I'll write the article next week, I'm getting very close to writing it, saying, you know, why are these characteristics in this birth certificate?
Are you talking about that doodling, those strange numbers that no one can figure out?
No, I'm talking about the X, you know, take a look at Onaka's stamp, the state registrar's stamp, and blow it up.
Right.
It's got a misspelling. It's an X-E or a K-E. It's really a K.
Oh.
The record is T-X-E or T-K-E. That's what I call a walking K. It's a K with leaning forward to the right. And then then if you take a look at the loop of the A in Alvin Onaka's signature, this is a rubber stamp. There's a smiley face in the forward loop of the A.
Uh-huh.
And that smiley face is made by inserting the letter E there.
Uh-huh. I've seen that.
Well, somebody's embedded the name Mike into this document. I'm going to talk about that next week.
Okay. Well, you know the liberal explanation for the K or the X in the middle of the word the, and that is, well, that was just a scanner trying to make sense of the word.
Yeah, or scanner, or it was a faulty stamp that had too much ink. Well, look, this is supposed to be the birth certificate of the President of the United States. It's one of the most important and likely to be famous documents in American history. You mean they couldn't get the stamp right? They couldn't. we messed up the stamp. Don't worry about it. Nobody's going to care. Don't do it over again. Don't get the stamp right. We don't care. Well, so the ink smeared. I mean, come on. If you're going to be releasing this kind of a document, you got it legitimate. The document is perfect when you release it. Otherwise, it's forged.
Well, again, I've got Carl Denninger coming on in just a couple of minutes, and I think he may have put it best in one of our off-air conversations when he said in certain ways this document may be a giant middle finger from the Obama administration to conservatives, meaning that we're so untouchable with the media on our side, we can do whatever in the hell we want to, and you still can't stop us.
Well, certainly it's tempting to think that, especially when you study how the you know, P.J. Foggy and Riker and these other guys behave. They act as if they are like Donald Segretti, smarter than everybody, don't have to follow the laws, can screw with you, you're stupid. They're going to make you look stupid. That's their whole approach. And also, you know, forgers like to embed their signature in forged documents. There's nothing a painting forger likes than for 50 years their Van Gogh held and, you know, was hanging in the Louvre until some expert comes and notices a little detail and say, did you know that that is so-and-so's painting and it was not a Van Gogh? They love
right.
that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody paid $50 million for their forgery. And it's actually, you know, there's actually forgerers whose work is collected because of those kind of characteristics.
Well, I could see this one getting a lot of money on eBay if there's actually a paper original, but
well,
there's not.
I, you know,
it was constructed.
Why the loop in the A of Alvin, that smiley face, if that was caused by some little pieces of dust on the scanner or a smudge on the paper, come on, give me a break. Somebody takes a look at that and says, let's do this over again. This is not right.
Absolutely.
Or says that X in the E. I've seen hundreds of Alvin Onaka's rubber stamps. None of them include a misspelling. If you've got a misspelling in a rubber stamp, you might use it once or twice, but you throw it away.
Exactly. Well, that's all the time we have for this segment today. I'm going to encourage all my listeners to go out and buy a copy of Where's the Birth Certificate, the case that Barack Obama is not eligible to be president. We've got those links up on our website, teapartypowerhour.com. Right now, Dr. Corsi, thank you so much for being with us. We all look forward to seeing the articles that you release next week.
Great, great pleasure to be with you, and I look forward to coming back.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Corsi.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
My next guest is Carl Denninger. Carl is the recipient of an AIM, and that stands for Accuracy in Media Award. He actually received the Grassroots Award for his efforts in exposing the true cost of the bailouts and the stimulus package. But we've got Carl here today because Carl is, in fact, an expert on computer documents, and he was the first to expose on YouTube the kerning that can be found in the birth certificate that was released by the White House, as well as numerous other anomalies in the document that point to the fact that it very well might be less than genuine. Carl is one of those people that just believes in exposing the truth whenever he can find it, and it is a pleasure to have him on the show today. Carl, welcome. Let's try that again. Carl, welcome. Now we've got you on.
Hi, Ty. How are you?
I'm doing good. I know you're in the middle of driving somewhere, so thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, not a problem at all. Actually, I pulled off here in a McDonald's parking lot, so make sure we keep a good signal.
Fantastic. McDonald's just got a free ad. well, listen, your YouTube video has hit over 300,000 views. Now, if you'd have asked me, Carl, I would have thought you'd have to have a college girl flashing the camera in order to get those kind of numbers. How did you get that many views for your YouTube video on Barack Obama's birth certificate?
Well, I think people just, you know, they decided to get interested in it. It's like anything else on YouTube. You never know what's going to actually get picked up and go viral and what's not. And there seems to be, you know, even among the so-called party faithful, if you will, there seems to be a fair degree of skepticism as to whether or not what we're being told in this case is the truth. And I think skepticism is healthy. I believe that people ought to be questioning what they are told and ought to be analyzing the facts as opposed to taking things, you know, as okay, well, you know, I was told this, therefore it must be true. Because oftentimes, as we've discovered, not just with the government, but certainly including the government, that is just false.
Well, I want to get this out in the open because I read this online. You actually voted for Barack Obama, did you not?
Yes, I did. And
okay,
in fact,
so you're not some
Republican
hack who's trying to do a smear job.
No, there's actually, if you go back and you look in the archives and the market ticker, just before the election and a couple of days before, I explained why I was voting for him. It drew a lot of comments and some amazing stares. But there were a number of things that happened during the campaign that made it impossible for me to vote for Mr. McCain. So, you know, there you have it. I mean, you have to play, you know, you have to cast a vote for somebody, and the you know, the hope was that we'd actually see some kind of constructive change, and of course, as we now know, that hasn't happened.
Well, you know, I'm kind of reminded, first of all, you had the choice between two Democrats, and you went with the one that was most open about his policies and his ideology, so that's great. I'm kind of reminded of the movie, I think it was it Dog Day Afternoon with Al Pacino, where they tried to slip an undercover cop in on him as the driver of the limo, and he figured out it was a cop, so he asked them to put an actual cop in the driver's seat. He said, at least with that guy, I know what I'm dealing with. I kind of feel the same way about Barack Obama. At least with him, we knew what we were dealing with. I always saw McCain as being Democrat light, so I didn't think we even had a true conservative or Republican in the race. But enough about politics. Let's talk about the document itself. You were the first, unless I'm mistaken, to expose the kerning issue. Explain to the listeners what kerning is, when it came about, and why it's important as it relates to this document.
Well, kerning is something that is done to make text easier to read. It has to do with the interaction of your eyes and your brain and the way that you process information. Essentially, what happens is the space between type elements is altered slightly so that the text appears more pleasant to the eye. And that's done by moving some elements slightly closer together and some slightly further apart. The problem with doing this, of course, is that a typewriter does not know what the next letter is that you are going to press. And being a mechanical device, it also doesn't know what the last letter you pressed was. So it doesn't have any way to make those adjustments. And as a result, a typewritten document will never show those kinds of changes. They're most obvious when you see type elements that actually have an overlap. There will, in typewritten text, there will always be a little bit of space between elements of letters because, again, you don't know what the letter is going to be that's typed next. So as a result, you can't adjust the spacing. And this is something, however, that when a computer is involved or if you're manually typesetting text in an offset press, it's very easy to do. And, in fact, it should be done because it makes it easier to read. So when you see this in a typewritten document, it means one of a couple of things. You know, and again, this is the old Sherlock Holmes thing. When we eliminate all of the things that cannot be, whatever we're left with has to be true. And when you see it in typewritten documents, it either means that what you're looking at isn't a typewritten document, which is, of course, how Dan Rather got caught.
Right.
The other possibility is that the typewriter carriage itself is loose. In other words, the stops for each of the positions are worn out. And that can happen. That's a malfunction in the typewriter. And the third possibility is that the little hammers that carry the individual letters are bent. And that, too, can happen. That's a defect in the typewriter. So we have to eliminate those other two possibilities. We know from the date of the birth certificate and from the introduction of various types of typewriters that this almost certainly had to be a bow or basket typewriter. In other words, the traditional kind that you see that looks like there's a basket with a bunch of metal letters up across the top that move up and strike it. It could not be a Selectric because the Selectric was introduced 1 month before Obama was born, and it's extraordinarily unlikely that the hospital would have managed to get their hands on one of these things in Hawaii, okay, in less than 1 month.
Secondly, it would have been very expensive too, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if you ship something on a ship, it takes, you know, 2 to 3 weeks to get to Hawaii, right, from the mainland. So
right.
Why would you air freight a, you know, 70-pound machine? That would be crazy. The other thing that we know that leads us to be reasonably certain that this was a bow typewriter is that bow typewriters will always misstrike capital letters high and always misstrike lowercase letters low, and that is because when you type a capital letter with a bow typewriter, the actual bow itself moves down. And so if it doesn't move all the way down because you don't push the shift key all the way, then the letter will strike high on the page. You will never see a capital letter on a bow typewriter that strikes low. And that is what we see in this document. So we have confirmation from the document itself that this was indeed a bow or a basket style typewriter. Well, that also tells us something else about the registration, if there was wear in the carriage mechanism, because those typewriters have essentially a spring, like a clockwork spring, that pulls the carriage from left to right. And so when they're worn, they will always be worn to the right-hand side. In other words, the character will always strike right of where it should if that particular little location for each of the carriage places is worn out.
Carl, if I can jump in for just a second. You said that before, kerning means adjusting some letters a little closer together and some letters a little farther apart. So what we're seeing here is that if there's going to be spacing that's off, it's going to be all in one direction, not left and right, to make it aesthetically pleasing.
Well, yes and no. Basically, what you have is kerning is done by a computer where individual pairs of letters are adjusted to make it visually pleasing. In some cases, one will be moved left and others a little right. But it requires foreknowledge, which,
correct,
of course, the typewriter doesn't have.
But with this particular document, we did not see shifting closer and farther apart. It was consistent, was it not?
Well, no, that's where the problem is. You see, if there was wear in the carriage, one of the explanations for this is that the carriage could be loose. In other words, the typewriter's worn out. But if that's the case, then each of the letters in, say, for example, character position 3 vertically would be off to the identical amount in the identical direction. So if it was going to be off to the right, they would all be off to the right in position 3 vertically. And that is not true. The other
That's the point I was trying to make, just not as articulately as
right.
you did.
Right. The other possibility is that the actual spring steel piece of metal that carries the hammer is bent, and that too can happen. Again, that's a defect. But if that's the case, then every instance of that letter will strike either left or right, because if the hammer's bent, it's going to be bent all the time. It's not only bent once in a while. Okay?
Right.
So again, we can look at the entirety of the document and say, okay, if the letter N is too far to the left in this one position, is it too far to the left in every position where an N appears in the document? And it has to be in every case. And it's not. So, again, we eliminate the possibility of the carriage being worn out or of the hammers being bent. And what I have left is that the original text had to have been picked up from another typewritten document and copied and pasted using a computer, because those documents that were used as the source, some of them could have had these defects, maybe some of them didn't have the defects, and now you have the inconsistencies that we actually see.
How many different typewriters and, you know, are we talking about? How many different types of type, if you will, are we seeing in this document?
Well, there only appears to be one typeface. That's not entirely clear that there are clearly, if you look at the actual characters themselves, and the copy that the White House has up on its website is a very poor quality. It has been intentionally compressed, and that makes it extremely difficult to do any kind of typographic analysis. But the copy that the Associated Press published was a scan from a piece of paper that they were handed from the White House. And that scan was of very high quality. And so when I did the typographic analysis, I used the AP's copy, and it appears from the Associated Press's copy that there were multiple typewriters, because even if you have two identical typewriters of the exact same make and model, they will have slight differences in the quality of the type they produce. For example, a letter R from one will not be exactly identical to a letter R from the other, simply because they're mechanical devices and each of them is unique. And this used to be a very important area of forensic analysis back in the days of typewriters, when people were trying to figure out if something had been forged. One of the ways that they did it was comparing the minute aspects of these, of, you know, the individual striking of letters under very high magnification. And we have some infirmities in this regard because of the quality of the documents we've been given to work with. But in the general sense, it does appear that there were multiple devices used to actually strike those letters.
Also, I would guess it was an important forensic tool to, say, analyze a ransom note or something. And I know many times as a young boy, you would read a news story and they would say police have confirmed that the ransom note was typed by the typewriter found in the suspect's home. So typewriter type has been around for a long time. Now, one of the things you said to me when I called you to invite you to be on the show is that there are a lot of little things wrong in this document, and yes, you can come up with alternative explanations. Well, maybe it was this and maybe it was that, but when you add them all together and look at the big picture and all the things that would have had to happen a certain way to create this document, the statistical odds become overwhelmingly against the fact that this is a genuine document.
Yeah, that's really the strongest piece of evidence that this is a forgery. You know, you can look at this, and because of the relatively poor quality of what we're able to work with here in the public, you can say, well, maybe there is a 1 in 5 chance, for example, that what we're really seeing here in the kerning is a matter of compression artifacts. In other words, when the computer interpreted this in a scanner, it interpreted it off a little bit, okay? And you can then look at, for example, the fact that the background does not appear to be consistent. In other words, this does not look like a scan of a piece of paper. It looks like somebody took a scan and then digitally assembled a piece of paper behind that. And you can say, well, what's the probability of that? And you say, well, maybe that's 1 in 5. And then you, for example, look at the fact that when you have a book that is copied on a flatbed scanner, there's a curvature to the paper, and that causes both a focus distortion because the paper is not directly against the glass where the spine of the book is. It also causes a curvature distortion, and those are inconsistent in the document. And you can
is
say,
that the
well,
parallax? I'm sorry, Carl. Is that the parallax issue that everyone's talking about?
There's a couple of different things with regards to parallax and chroma, and I was going to get to that one too.
Oh, sure.
But yes, that's part of the parallax issue that people are talking about. It's basically when I take a book and copy it with a spine, the paper is away from the glass by the spine of the book, and as a result, there's both a loss of focus, it gets further away from the glass, and there's also a curvature in the text that should be consistent, in a vertical plane in one place versus another. And when you look at this document, you'll see that the printed text that is on the document, for example, sex, okay, has one particular curvature associated with it, one arc associated with it, and the type text has a different radius. Well, that can't be true if, in fact, this is one piece of paper and was not assembled from multiple sources. They should both have the same curvature, and they do not. There's also the fact that when I look at the White House document, there is no chroma information in the scan. What I mean by that is when light passes through a lens, purple or blue light is refracted slightly differently than red light, and a scanner has red, green, and blue pixels that are illuminated, which are not all in exactly the same place. They can't be because you have a red sensor here, a green sensor here, and a blue sensor here, and they all have to be very close together, but they're not exactly on top of one another. And so what you normally will see in a scanned color document is a little bit of chroma fringing when you blow up the magnification. When you greatly magnify it, you'll see a little bit of red fringing on one side and purple fringing on the other. And that is both an optics issue and an issue within the sensor itself. And it's almost impossible to make that not happen. Well, that's not there, again, in the White House document. And yet we know that was a color scan because the background is green, okay? If it was a black or white and white scan, you wouldn't expect to see it. But we know that it was a color scan. And so there's all of these things. When you take each of them, you can say, well, you know, maybe there was an optimization that did this, and maybe there was an optimization that did that. I, for example, with the chroma issue and with the various layering that's in the document, I tried to reproduce the layering using my scanner, a auto title, which is printed on safety paper, and Adobe Acrobat Pro. I spent the better part of a day attempting it, and while I could easily get layers to show up, I couldn't get anything that looked like it had been intelligently selected.
And again, you know, National Review tried to debunk this layering thing when they ran this this passport application through, and unfortunately they ended up making my point instead of theirs, because while the layers were present, they didn't appear to be intelligent. In other words, they looked like a computer had made a decision as opposed to a person. Okay.
The layers do seem to occur at some very important key points in the document, no question about it.
Well, yeah, and here's the problem with that. If you take a piece of paper and scan it, and then go into Acrobat and say optimize PDF, okay, which is how those layers get created, you will get layers. But when you actually look at those layers in Illustrator, you'll see that there's no intelligence as to where they are. In other words, the computer says, okay, this part of the page looks kind of like this part of the page, so we're going to put those in a layer, okay? But it's a computer. It's a program. It doesn't have a mind. And therefore, it doesn't say, well, that looks like a date, so I'm going to put...
Right.
That sort of intelligence isn't there in a computer program. And yet you see that in this particular document. And that's very troubling, because that is the kind of thing that machines just don't do, all right? But again, if I take, let's say I can find 10 of these anomalies, and I give each of them a 20% chance of being just by random chance real, okay? In other words, not the result of somebody tampering with anything, not the result of manipulation, but just random odds. I end up with a 1 in a million chance that this document is authentic.
Well, I've always heard that Obama was 1 in a million, so maybe that's what they were talking about whenever they said that. Carl, in all seriousness, this document is fraudulent, is it not?
Well, you know, you have to understand there's a big difference between fraudulent and forged, okay? There's I assembled something, but what's there matches what's in the official records, all right, which is fraudulent, but the information is accurate. And then there is I created something out of whole cloth that doesn't exist, and the second one is forged, right? We do not know. I mean, I'm very comfortable saying that I believe that the document is fraudulent. The only way to prove that it is forged is for somebody with forensic knowledge and experience to go in there and examine the original piece of paper in the bound book. And if that is done, you're going to be able to determine two things. First, is the paper 50 years old? All right, you cannot take a piece of paper and insert it in a bound book. And remember, this is a pin binding thing, so you could open it up, take a page out, put a page in. You could tamper with it. Mm-hmm. It's not bound like you think of as a bound book. But if you did that and the paper was 5 years old, say, for example, it would be obvious on careful inspection, because the aging that would take place over 50 years didn't happen. The other thing that you could do, which would be fairly easy, would be to take a swab of the inks that are in the actual print and examine those chemically and determine whether or not the oxidation level and such is consistent with that ink having been exposed to the air for 50 years. And that's not too hard to do either. So, you know, a true forensic examination, non-destructive one, of this document would likely tell us the truth, assuming it, you know, and I am assuming it exists in the book, okay? I'm just not assuming that what's in the book was what was there 50 years ago. But if that is in fact the case, then, you know, I don't understand why there's such a resistance to this. I mean, you know, I'm sure WorldNet Daily and, you know, Jerome Crosi and a whole bunch of other people would be willing to, you know, spend the $20,000 or whatever it would cost to send two or three of these guys out there. You know, send a Democrat, send a Republican, and send one from WorldNet. So you got one of everybody, right? And get three expert opinions on whether or not this thing is actually real. And I think that would close the case. And I'm just, you know, stunned that people are so resistant to doing this, because it would answer the question once and for all.
Well, I don't think WorldNet Daily is resistant to doing this, but if you're waiting on the Obama administration to say, hey, this is a great idea, you better mark your calendar for whenever hell freezes over, because they're not going to go for it. Just to give you an update, I know they didn't pull you into the queue until late in the Corsi interview, but according to Jerome Corsi, and if you read WorldNet Daily, Major General Vallely has come out and said that there are now 3X CIA officials who are confirming that the electronic document is fraudulent. And also, Corsi is very close to naming the actual forger and may actually do that as quickly as next week. So, or not for, go ahead.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at that. You know, one of the things that's kind of interesting is it's forgery is kind of a funny thing in that there's two possibilities. Of course, one is that this was an extraordinarily clumsy thing, and the other is that this was done by somebody who was basically hired to do it. What I find interesting about this is that here we have an alleged White House document. Produced, allegedly this is a scan produced by the White House, right? That's what this is, the narrative that we've been sold. And yet the tags in the file are conclusive for the final output of this thing having come out of a Macintosh and not from Adobe's tools, but from a internal part of the Macintosh operating system. Now, I find it personally astounding that in the White House, the wealthiest planet on the wealthiest nation on the planet, the most important office in the world, it produces a document in PDF format, which is a proprietary format owned by Adobe, and doesn't use Adobe's tools in their own offices to produce that which they put out to the public. I'm just a lowly guy that writes a blog and works with Photoshop and has done document imaging for 25 years, and I have a licensed copy of all of the Adobe tools that are used in the production of that kind of thing. You would think that the White House would have those kinds of things on their computers, that they would have, real, honest-to-God, no BS licensed copies of Adobe software on their machines. Why wouldn't they?
I agree. Now, what program was this thing likely made in? I think you've noted it on your website or on your YouTube video.
The program itself is not able to be determined. It's but the actual PDF itself was produced produced on an Apple Macintosh. The actual distiller is part of the Macintosh's operating system. And I don't remember the exact name of it, but I looked it up because it's rather funny. And the chain of software, when you look at where this actually came from, you find that it's traced to an Indonesian company. And a lot of people jumped on that originally. I thought it was extremely suspicious until I realized that, hey, wait a minute, this is actually part of what comes with a Mac in the basic operating system. It's in there. It's part of the base tools. So that's where the actual PDF was produced from. And now, of course, it's possible somebody went in and edited that information. It's called metadata that's embedded in the file, but it's highly unlikely. And in all probability, that document came out of a Mac.
Gotcha. Well, with the time that we have left, tell the folks listening how they can learn more about your various internet activities, your blog site and YouTube channel and everything else you've got going.
Well, I write daily, mostly on the economy and the markets. It's at market-ticker.org. And I have a YouTube channel associated with that, and occasionally post various videos related to whatever it is that's going on at the particular time.
Well, Carl, it has been an absolute pleasure having you here today. Thank you for shedding a lot of additional and much needed light on this subject. We look forward to having you back as the spam gets closer to hitting the fan.
I would be more than honored to do so.
Fantastic. Carl, thanks once again. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And that's all we have time for today, folks. I want to remind everybody that we're going to have Janie Johnson on next week. She is the author of Don't Take My Lemonade Stand, and we're giving away a free copy. Just go to teapartypowerhour.com and follow the instructions at the top of the page to enter into the drawing. Now, tomorrow, we're going to have Ben Shapiro, who is the author of Primetime Propaganda, and he's going to be telling us about all those hidden liberal messages that are placed in between our favorite television shows, dating all the way back to shows we watched as children, like Sesame Street. Once again, thank you for being here today. We hope that you'll go to our homepage, teapartypowerhour.com, subscribe to our newsletter, follow us on Twitter, friend us on Facebook, interact with us in any way that you can. We love that. Or just send me an email at mark@teapartypowerhour.com, suggest a guest, make a suggestion for improving the show, anything other than changing the host, and we will certainly take that into consideration. That's all we have time for today. Once again, thank you for being with us.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.